you are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. Today I'm speaking via the mobile phone with Shane Guthbert from Cairns, Australia. He has an extraordinary background, a background that once saw him labelled as Australia's most evil husband by the media, for which he received a lot of hate and abuse. He also spent time in custody several times during his youth, experiencing horrifying trauma. Yet against all odds, he has been able to turn things around and today has a double degree in psychology and law from Central Queensland University and running as an independent for Cairns Council, together with another independent, former magistrate Pat O'Shane, who once sentenced Shane as a youth offender. Welcome, Shane Guthbert.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Growing up, did you have a male role model around who you looked up to?
Look, I didn't really. I mean, there's not one that I can sort of name and say, you know, that was my role model. If anything, I probably had many. Obviously, I had throughout my schooling some great school teachers. I didn't have contact with my dad from about age 4 to 15 or 16, which caused me a lot of grief as a child, I think, dealing and not understanding, you know, the relationship breakdown of parents. You know, I was young, I just couldn't figure out why I couldn't go home anymore. You know, had I done something? Was it my fault? And I've worked with since a lot of adults that, you know, have also felt the same way, blame themselves for their parents' divorce. And obviously it's got nothing to do with the children. That's a choice that some parents make. And it's just poorly handled sometimes, I think, and it's at the expense of the children. And when you're a child, you can't speak up and you can't tell your parents about that. I remember when I was a child, I didn't really understand what was happening myself. So I wasn't in a position where I could talk to my mum and say, hey, I'm feeling this way, or, you know, I'm confused about this. It just never really happened, unfortunately. And it's not until, you know, you're in your 20s and 30s, or you do a lot of soul searching and, you know, you ask those questions, but you start finding the answers. So it was really a confusing time for me as a child, and not having that sort of male role model. I mean, when I was a young child, I was lucky. I had my grandfather. He was great. He was the only person that really, I feel like, loved me unconditionally. My mum, I think, struggled having young kids as a single mum, trying to study, trying to work and juggle, you know, kids at the same time. And, you know, she was young herself, you know, she was 20. So to have two young kids, you know, under the age of 4 at that time was difficult for her. And I remember I used to get in trouble and I used to get sent away to my grandparents' house. And, you know, they never asked me what I had done wrong or never blamed me or punished me for anything. They just sort of gave me this unconditional love. My grandpa was a builder and he'd always just say, look, here's a paintbrush. Let's go paint the house. Let's go build something. Let's put something together. So he turned sort of that negative energy into positive stuff. And he passed away, sadly, when I was, you know, in my early sort of teenage years, a real pivotal time.
Okay. What about schooling?
My schooling was really interesting. So in Australia, we have really 12 years of schooling split into primary school and then high school. I only did maybe 4 or 5 years, maybe, of schooling. I did my first 3 years schooling. I was actually getting bullied by other kids at the time. I had an injury. One of these kids picked me up, threw me to the ground. I had a compound arm fracture, which meant that I spent a few weeks in hospital recovering. While I was in hospital, I got addicted to morphine, which was a real terrible time for me, coming down off that, just vomiting and being sick and things like that. And I was still struggling with, not having a father figure and some issues at home. And so I actually went back to school and I confronted these bullies. I took a little pocket knife to school and I didn't do anything. But because I'd done that, the police were called and I wasn't expelled from school, but I was obviously asked not to come back. And the teachers were aware that, I was obviously suffering from some issues and I needed some help. So I actually then spent almost 12 months in a hospital for kids, really, for a mental assessment and things like that. And that was not ideal for me because I was around a lot of other kids that were more, there were kids there that were more violent. There were kids there that, could swear and use more profanity. There were kids that had some serious mental health issues. And I really learn a lot of bad habits there. And I really then learn a lot of things that weren't good. And as a kid that wasn't getting attention from my father, the attention I was getting from my mum, I don't think was very good. I was learning then to get attention in negative ways and acting out. And I just never fit back into the schooling system again. So, fast forward,
How old were you?
when the accident happened, I was about 7 or 8.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was quite young. And then from about age 9, I was still in the mental hospital, for children. And, so then my early teenage years, I was actually homeschooled by my mum. So that conventional, schooling and stuff, I didn't really have. And obviously, one of the greatest hurdles for me in my early teens was that social aspect. So, I was doing the homeschooling and, learning, to read and write and do, mathematics and all of those sorts of things that you learn at school. So I was learning the theory, but, I was missing out on having friends and, hanging out at lunchtime and that social aspect. So I found it really difficult to try and fit in with other teenagers and make friends, later on as well, which caused me a bit of trouble as well.
So, thinking back, do you remember how old you were when things led you astray and you began being involved with petty crime offenses? Was that the kind of the starting point when you were 8, when you brought the knife to school?
Look, that was probably where it started. It certainly, I think it got worse after I went to the mental hospital because I learned all these bad habits, these negative ways of getting attention. But really, that struggle in those early teenage years, 12, 13, struggling to fit in with friends. I'm hanging out with the wrong crowd. I'm doing bad things. We used to go around at night and break stuff. We wouldn't go home. And getting involved in the petty crime and obviously then having interactions with police. So I'd say my very early teens, that transition period between being a child and going into being a teenager, the 12, 13 years old was, I think where it sort of started. Yeah.
What role do you think substance abuse and mental health issues had on your decision? Were you diagnosed with a mental health issue?
No, so I wasn't,
I mean, 8 years
I
old.
wasn't,
That's a bit very, that's young, isn't it?
Yes. And I think at the time, I think we've come a long way. I certainly know, having studied psychology now, we know a lot more about children. I mean, I look back at my childhood and I think there was a lot of people around me that were really confused and they didn't know what was happening. You know, certainly my parents, but even, you know, doctors, nurses, psychologists and things. I was trialed on, you know, a whole bunch of medications. I was used for testing for different programs and different initiatives. And then I think in the end, that was just further negatively impacting me because I sort of became this test dummy for all these things. And obviously, there's a lot of people around me trying to work out what's wrong. And now, as an adult, I can see that it was just, you know, not having a dad and some of those family issues where early on, if I had that explained to me maybe a bit more and, you know, could do some counseling or some work around that, earlier, I wouldn't have found myself in that same situation.
But do you really think, as a youngster, you would be happy to receive counseling if you already got into bad habits and you're opposing police and you know what I mean?
Look, I don't know. I mean, for me personally, I think I was always seeking, you know, love and guidance and support. I think I would have valued that to have that connection. It's hard to say looking back because I was sort of, you know, I guess acting out and you know, being anti-police and that sort of thing. But I do think that if I just had have had a bit more support, I think that would have been great. I think I would have welcomed it. I think I would have liked that. The positive attention as opposed to the negative attention that comes with doing, you know, bad stuff. I mean, I used to get bored and go into the police station and throw eggs at their cars and just so they could chase me. And, you know, it was like I had nothing else to do and I wanted their attention and it was all sort of fun and games. I never really hurt anybody. And then all of a sudden you turn, you know, 18 and it's, look, you're looking at prison and it gets a lot more serious, obviously, as you get older.
Absolutely. So you were quite aware of the choices you made as a youngster, like, you know, when you were 18.
I don't think I was at the time. I mean, now that I'm looking back, I'm very, I see things maybe through a little bit of a different lens.
Okay.
But yeah, no, at the time, you know, I didn't really care. And this is because of the, obviously, substance abuse plays a huge, huge role as well. So you're not thinking clearly. I know that at that time, you know, obviously my brain was underdeveloped. I wasn't thinking clearly anyway. So to mix that with substances and other things, it really is, you know, like sort of a mixture for disaster, really.
Influence did social media have on you?
Oh, look, by the time social media was really popular, I mean, so I grew up when I was a teenager and we didn't really have mobile phones yet. I'm 33, so you know, social media for me, I think that was, yes, maybe around being 18, early 20s probably became or started becoming a popular thing. Obviously, it's, you know, everyone has social media now. But I remember probably first getting a Facebook around that 18, 20 years old mark. And it wasn't at the time. We thought it was for old people at the time. In all honesty, I remember thinking, oh, you know, my mum has Facebook. It's for old people. You know, we weren't really interested in that stuff at the time. Obviously, it changed later. I'm big on social media at the moment. But yeah, no, we grew up in a time, I think, really, you know, I was on that line where social media came in. You know, 10 years before that, people grew up didn't have it, and then now obviously it's a huge thing. I've got a younger brother who's 18 and he's grown up his whole life with social media and mobile phones and things. But for me, you know, my early life, we didn't really have that, and we certainly didn't embrace it.
You know, in Australia, you got this saying, a bloke. How
Yeah.
important was it to you to be a bloke? Or how did you see yourself?
Oh, look, see, for me, because I didn't really have those male role models. I mean, I don't really feel like I had this. I didn't really have anyone to learn, you know, really what being a bloke was, or you know, and I think that that shows in a lot of my early years, even my early 20s. I mean, I was charged with offences and I went to court in a clown costume. I mean, I was acting like a kid. You know, in my early 20s, no one really showed me how to be an adult or how to grow up. I think I look back on, you know, where I was at that time in my life, and I think I was doing a lot of stupid things and a lot of dumb things. And I think that's because I didn't have, I was kicked out of home by my mum very early on. So I didn't have that. I didn't have that family environment. I didn't have that mum and dad. I'd lost my grandparent, you know, that I looked up to very much when I was younger. So I didn't really have that, you know, at the time. I'm just hanging around a bunch of other kids that are also out on the streets committing crimes, breaking things.
What is a good male role model? If you were the way you are thinking today, and if you could say to your younger self, your 8-year-old, what would he look like?
Look, I think it's someone for me is just kind and caring and accepting. You know, I know that when I was a kid, I was missing that. And it's just someone that's there to guide you, you know, to say, hey, look, it's okay. Obviously, someone you can turn to, that you can confide in, you know, and come to when you've got issues or thoughts. You know, you want to naturally say, hey, so this thing happened. You know, how do I navigate this?
Mm-hmm.
Where do I go? So I think relationships are important. And I think especially for males, because we have this, there's a lot of men out there that have this idea that, you know, you can't be soft and kind and things like that. But I do think that it's really important. I think it's more important than possibly any other factor for kids, especially, you know, wayward kids that sort of, they need that. They need to know that they've got that support there.
So what is interesting is that you haven't mentioned this about, you know, your mother. You haven't really spoken about your mother, but so, and I'm not sure exactly, was it a good relationship or what kind of relationship, but I'm wondering then how does your relationship with your mom affect your relationship with women?
I have a good relationship with her now. For most of our life, my early childhood, it was not a good relationship. I've got a partner now that I've had for 5 years. She's great. I don't know how it's affected my relationship with women. I mean, I still love women. I've you know, got a partner. I haven't really thought about it, to be honest. I mean, it's taken us a long time and a lot of work, I think, me and my mum to come together. And I think that's part of being an adult too, to have those conversations. You know, in the last 2 years, we've been able to reconnect and I've been able to sit down and say, hey, mum, look, this is not right. You know, what happened when I was a kid, or really sit down and speak about those issues. And I think it's a maturity thing. I think it's just part of growing up, or it's been like that way for me anyway. It's been, look, I grow up, I'm an adult now, and I'm confident, and I'm doing things with my life, and I can sit down and say, hey, look, mum, this was not okay, but, you know, we'll move forward now, and we've got a great relationship.
So where did you get this labelled as Australia's most evil husband?
Yeah, so that was in 2016. My only marriage at the time. I was married. I was married to a model who was quite well known. And she made a lot of very public allegations about that to the media. So the media sort of turned it into a huge thing. I mean, it went viral around the world. I wasn't charged or convicted with any of the offences. So really it was the media that gave me that label, you know, really probably because of who my wife was at the time and her popularity. I mean, it's certainly not a label that that I like or asked for. It is something now that I've embraced, and I now work with a lot of men struggling in Australia with domestic violence, and I try to support them as best as I can. So I just figured that I like taking negative situations. I've learnt over the years to take negative situations and try to make a positive out of them, you know, and say, okay, well, this label's there. What am I going to do about it that, you know, helps me and also helps others at the same time? And my life now as an adult, I mean, I do so much community work and I work in so many advocacy spaces. And I think that's just, you know, really comes back to that that reframing of negative things and making them positive. And, you know, how do we learn from this? How do we make changes? How do we make things better? And I've dedicated really the rest of my adult life to that.
I think it's amazing some of the things that you are involved with. But just very briefly coming back to this, thinking about domestic violence and violence against women.
Yeah.
I mean, it is an ongoing phenomena worldwide.
Yes.
And I got a couple of questions. Why do you think this is so? And can domestic violence ever be solved?
Look, it's really a two-part question. It is something that is, you know, around the world is out of control. And what we've seen now from the research and the data is that it is a gender-based issue. It is an issue. It is, you know, it comes back to those expectations we place on men and the masculinity and things like that, which, you know, traditionally, yes, you know, men were hunters and women were sort of gatherers and nurturers. And that's starting to change now. And I think what's happening there is you've got these masculine perceptions and expectations, and we're being placed, you know, as men into, you know, our situations are changing. You've got stay-at-home dads and things. And I think that socially we are struggling to adapt and keep up. And obviously it's interesting that it seems to be men specifically that, you know, are really struggling with that. You know, I think women are really embracing, you know, the workplace and going. We've got women that are in the armed forces, you know, in Australia and other countries as well. You've got and doesn't seem to have the stigma attached to that like it does with men. And the second question is, you know, is there something we can do about it? I like to focus on the prevention. I know in our country, in Australia, you know, we're doing a lot where we are submitting perpetrators to these domestic violence orders where they are not allowed to go to the house, they're not allowed to see their children. I feel that places them under additional pressure. So they've obviously having a relationship breakdown, or, you know, there's clearly something that's going on in the home, but they're not getting that support that they need. They're not getting the counselling. They're not getting, you know, someone around there to try and address those issues. And I'd like to see more of that. And so I know here I'm active advocating for that as much as I can. I think that we are addressing, we're throwing a lot of money and ideas and programs that are really aimed for after violence has occurred, or, you know, after someone leaves prison, or while a woman is trying to leave the relationship. And that's great. There's some great work in that space. But I think it's time we need to start looking at early prevention. How do we get in there earlier and prevent these things happening? You know, I obviously work in the youth justice space, and I'm anti-prisons and things like that. And really the idea behind that is, you know, if we've got someone committing a crime, you know, and we're locking them away as a punishment, you know, that's great. But why aren't we looking at preventing the crime in the first place, you know, with social supports and housing? And obviously there's a whole lot of things that go into that. But I think the same applies in the domestic violence space. You know, I think if we've got families or men that, you know, are having troubles with their anger or, you know, there's arguments in the home and things like that, why are we not looking at, you know, therapeutic-based approaches early on, you know, to make sure that obviously women are safe, children are safe. You know, we often forget that there's a lot of children that may not be they may not be physically abused, but, you know, I've met a lot of kids that are now adults that have grown up in abusive households. And, you know, some have become abusers themselves because that's what they were taught. That's what they learned, you know, in their fundamental years. So it's a cycle then that we need to break. So, you know, children are key in this as well.
I just think there is something to be said about the identity of the male, and it sometimes it seems like it's not quite clear, and that is why a lot of young men choose to go into social media and join all kinds of insidious groups. Or and you're talking about that needs to be prevented before, and I'm just, what do you mean? When would you do that? I mean, and how?
Look, I think it starts with, you know, educating kids, you know, and parents as well at the same time, you know, and men that do have children, you know, whether that be maybe men's groups or something that has a focus on raising children and you know, what does maybe punishment look like? Or you know, I know in Australia now we cannot, there's no abuse at all for children. It's not acceptable. But for many years, I know when I was growing up, you know, physical violence from my mum when I was, you know, did the wrong thing, you know, happened a lot. And so you normalize it as a child, and you grow up and you're an adult then that, you know, is capable of violence. So, you know, it really starts with children is really early prevention. But the men that we've already got, it's education. It's you know, I think it looks like guys like me that have been there and been through that and come through the other side and now have healthy relationships and sort of, you know, pulling them aside and saying, look, this is the way and this is how you do it. And it's okay. You know, we have this idea as men that we can't talk, we can't seek help. Our suicide rate for men in Australia is 3.5 times that of women, and that's because men don't seek help. Men don't seek support. Men don't seek support for their mental health issues or their substance abuse issues. They're ashamed. There's a lot of guilt. There's a lot of pressure. And we need to change all that. And that's something that I'm doing now, you know, in this domestic violence space specifically. You know, I've spoken about this issue before, and I get a lot of I get a lot of criticism that, you know, I run male domestic violence groups where we support one another and sort of peer support mentorship. And I think that's great. And I know that that works. But, you know, we've had some negative comments and negative feedback. And, you know, people think we're sort of this domestic violence group getting together and, you know, which is not the case. You know, we're really trying to focus on prevention. And I think that comes from support and telling other men that, hey, I've been where you are. I've walked in your shoes, and it's okay to seek help. And I think that's something we need to do in many spaces. I mean, domestic violence is one. The mental health space is another. We're losing, you know, far too many men. So we need, I think, really to champion, you know, people like me that are out there saying, hey, I'm a man and I sought help. I mean, I certainly did at many stages throughout my life. And my, I guess, if you call it success later in life, really, I mean, I can pinpoint that to a psychologist who now is a friend, but, you know, was visiting me in prison because I had no family to visit me. So he come in for free just to come and visit me. So I had some sort of social link. And you know, that meant the world to me, because I got out and I sort of thought, hey, I want to do the right thing for this person that's, you know, taken their time to come and help me. And that really worked for me. So I try to do that for other people. I try to be there for other men that are reaching out and seeking help.
You are now working on possible solutions and alternatives to reducing youth crime. Sorry, can you talk about what it involves?
Yeah, so I advocate here, our government, when we bring in new legislation, they form committees, and what they do is they seek submissions. I've made quite extensive submissions to various committees. I've been asked to speak to them. So these are government officials that are looking at bringing in new laws or funding particular programs, etc. So I do a lot of work in that space. I also do a lot of work with kids in the community. I've worked on various projects and initiatives over the last couple of years. And I have been advocating in my local community for a 24-hour youth centre, because we have a lot of disadvantaged youth where I live, and our crime rate is quite high. And in particular, the youth crime rate here is particularly high. And crime peaks between midnight and 2 a.m. And these are children that they can't go home, and that may be because there's domestic violence or substance abuse at home. And, you know, they're out walking the streets, they steal cars, they break into things. And this is at a time where there's no other services operating at night, you know. And so I think that that's a gap, and that's something that needs to be addressed, and I've been advocating for that. But also just because I was one of those youth. So I can relate to how they're feeling. You know, they don't come from the best circumstances, whether there's been a breakdown in their relationships with their parents. Some of them are actually in foster homes. They've been removed from their parents because of violence, or their parents are in prison, or, you know, there's drug use. There's also quite a lot of sexual abuse that has occurred. There's a lot of children here that have been sexually abused, you know, by family members as well, which is quite traumatic for them. And they don't know how to deal with that. And what it looks like is, it looks like youth crime. It looks like breaking into houses, breaking things. It's that anger. It's that hurt. It's that these terrible things have happened to me. What outlet do I have to, you know, get those emotions out? And it looks like committing crime, unfortunately. And we've got a lot of people in the community that want to see an end to it. You know, they want to lock these kids up forever and throw away the key. I'm anti-prisons for this reason, that basically I think that kids go to prisons. There's more sexual abuse, and there's terrible things that happen in prison. Terrible things happen to me. And that creates a lot more hurt and anger. And then one day the door is open and you're released, but there's no support, there's no programs, there's no rehabilitation. And we're just releasing now these traumatized people into the community, and they do more crime. It's more serious crime, more violent crime. We have a prison in Queensland, the state where I live in Australia, that it's supermax. It's the basically for the worst of the worst offenders, and there's only 12. So 12 of the most worst offenders in Queensland, and 10 of them were children who actually spent time in custody. We had a prison for women, where women who were pregnant were allowed to give birth in prison and raise their children in prison. And 10 of those kids have grown up, and they're, you know, 10 of the 12 most violent criminals in the state. So, you know, there's plenty of research there that shows that, you know, locking people up is not the right way. We need to give them love, kindness, care, address their needs. You know, if they're struggling with mental health issues, then they need some support around that. Psychologists, counselling programs, if they're struggling with, often goes hand in hand, you know, your addiction issues with your mental health issues. Usually people get into addictions as a way to cope with that trauma, you know, from their childhood. So we need to start looking, I think, at addressing those needs. And there's a lot of people that are, and we're just not seeing the funding. Our government is actually at the moment spending a lot of money to build new youth prisons because the ones that we have are full. So they're actually going the opposite way. They're actually funding more punishment rather than funding, you know, more services and support that actually helps these kids.
And it would be ongoing support you're talking about.
Yeah.
So it's not a quick fix.
No, certainly not. Yeah. You know, some of these kids have experienced, you know, some of the worst things that you can think of, and we expect them to behave and do the right thing, and it's just they need a lot of work and a lot of support.
Mm-hmm. Now you are also involved with a lot of other issues, or you advocate for a lot of things such as that also relate to, I would imagine, reducing or trying to reduce youth crime, and that relates to homelessness.
Yes, yeah.
And so what is the situation about homelessness in your part of the world in Cairns?
So since COVID, our homelessness has skyrocketed. In part, I think, because we had a lot of maybe Australians overseas that during COVID they flew home, which took up a lot of additional housing that we did not have. Then we had a housing boom where prices, just went through the roof, and rentals and the costs for homes just became quite. Just trying to think of the word, inflated. So a lot of people, was unaffordable for a lot of people. So a lot of people started turning to, you know, living in their cars, living on the streets, just for the simple fact that they couldn't afford a home, because we've got a lack of housing here. In the town where I live, Cairns, we have 6,000 people here at risk of homelessness, and our population's only about 120,000. So, you know, that's about, just trying to think, is my maths correct? It's about 5% of our population, which is probably not a lot in the grand scheme of things. But, I mean, that's a lot of 6,000 people in our town that are at risk of homelessness. Mm-hmm. is really quite incredible. And that's an issue that we have here. And we used to have homeless shelters and things, which for whatever reason mm-hmm. have been shut down recently. So these people are starting to... very, very visibly, it's a visible issue now. We have a lot of tourism in our town. We have the Great Barrier Reef. We have the Daintree Rainforest, and people travel from all over the world to come here. And we're just seeing homelessness on the rise, you know, people, because they can't go to these shelters anymore. They're on the streets, yeah.
So what are you doing about it?
Well, look, at the moment.
So come on.
This is one of the reasons why I'm now running for council. I've experienced homelessness myself. I've experienced, you know, youth crime myself. I've been a youth offender. So these are issues that are really our big issues at the moment. And there's something that I've got a little bit of experience with. So I want to get into, power, or to get into council, so I can get in there and make some changes instead of waiving development applications for, you know, big fancy buildings. We can look at supporting homeless shelters again and getting people off the street and really focusing more on our disadvantaged here. So that's really my reason for running for election, is really to address some of these social issues, things that I think other people have put in the too hard basket and thought, look, we don't want to tackle this. I certainly want to get in and do some good.
You know, I've been thinking about why would you turn around, and, you know, you've turned around your life amazingly.
Yeah.
But particularly you have a drive to make changes, and then you're pushing for changes. You kind of, like, you do believe in solutions, and you believe in long-term solutions, from how I understand the stuff that I read about you. And I can only imagine that the people you're up against, sometimes, you know, it's like we talk about, what do they know about the real world?
Yes.
You know, and of course, coming a, coming across a person like yourself who is not only really, well, you articulate beautifully, you know the issues. And I think because you know the issues, they're so intimate, it's part of you, who you are. That may be threatening to some, you know, I don't know, maybe be threatening to someone, because sometimes I think that, look, it's like you become comfortable in your position.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's why a person like you, Shane, is hugely important.
This is why, you know, I'm running, is because I have that lived experience. I've been there, done that. And along the way, along the journey, I've been able to see firsthand what works, what doesn't. And I've also been able to think, hey, look, maybe something like this would have helped me when I was in that situation. And I think we've got to start listening. I think you're right. I think we've got to start listening to people that have that lived experience, that lived and breathed that space. And really, I'm really passionate about, you know, these things. And it really is because, you know, it also gives me purpose now later in life. I mean, I could have just got a job and thought, you know, I've changed my life. That's great. I'm just going to go and live the best of it, happily ever after. But for me, I have this drive to say, well, actually, no, that's not acceptable. Yeah. I'm not happy with that. I don't want somebody else to experience what I experienced. It's bad enough that I had to experience it. And I want to say, hey, you know what I want to do is turn around and change it so that other people don't have to do that. And that's what drives me and motivates me.
It is about having a purpose, but also it is about support. Now, you have, or I understand, the magistrate Pat O'Shane, who once actually was part of judging you when as a youth offender, and she is now a support. You guys kind of, she understands you and don't you? I mean, I think that sort of support and relationship is huge.
Yes. Look, and again, I have to agree. I mean, I recognize the importance of it. It's certainly not lost on me. I mean, having someone that has seen the worst of me and sentenced me and passed judgment on me to turn around later on and support me and say, you know, she did a radio interview actually recently, and she called me like an inspiration and a success story. And I was totally blown away by that. You know, I just thought, wow, that's incredible. I never in a million years would have thought, you know, if I went back in time to that time when she was sentenced to me, I never would have thought we would have this relationship. I never would have thought we could have connected. I never would have thought then that I would have that support. I mean, it's really, it blows me away still to this day. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's a credit to what I'm doing, and it's a credit to her as well for being open-minded. You know, we often think mm-hmm. these people that are in positions of power and they pass judgment on people, we think that they're against. We think that they are against us, you know, coming from that youth justice space. You know, we feel that the police are against us because they're trying to arrest us, and the judges are against us because they're trying to put us in prison. And I've been able to see another side of that now, you know, recently, is that they are actually incredibly proud to see you doing well and not going to prison and not being arrested. And I think that is just so powerful. I mean, it has been powerful for me. But I think if we can do the same or show that same compassion to the kids that are, you know, committing crimes now, we can really do some good. I think it's really powerful.
I only agree with you. I mean, I think it's amazing that you're entering politics. We need good politicians or people with real life experience and prepared to get their hands dirty. It's not going to be about the quick fix. It's going to be real solutions. Now, I got to ask you a question. What did you think about the Voice outcome, the referendum in Australia, the no outcome? What was that like for you?
Look, it's disappointing. I had I had a lot of friends that, you know, were voting yes, and I had a lot of friends that were voting no. And even now that the vote has been done, there is still a lot of division. There is still a lot of arguing about it. And I hate that. I want to bring people together. I want to see people connected. Pat O'Shane, the magistrate that I've been working with, she is Indigenous. In Australia, we have Indigenous people that we basically settled here, white settlers, you know, a couple hundred years ago. And there's a lot of this trauma, and there's a lot of this intergenerational trauma that, you know, it's been around for years. You know, we took their land, and, you know, about 100 years ago, we were taking their children from them and trying to breed them out. We did terrible things. And there's still a lot of that trauma felt here in our country today. And I think the voice really showed that. Obviously, there's a lot of people that were very upset. So my friend Pat, the Indigenous magistrate, she was the first Indigenous person in Australia to get a law degree, become a magistrate. She did a lot of things where she was the first to do so. So being able to work closely with her, you know, I've been able to see just how powerful, you know, making change is, but also the struggle behind it. You know, Indigenous people in this country are still struggling now. And I see it. I see it in our prisons, and I see it in the youth crime space. So with our prison population, when they split sort of Indigenous between white offenders, we've obviously got more white offenders. But when you look at the percentage of the population of Indigenous peoples in Australia, it is really, really. When you look at the incarceration rates, they're really, really high. And that's because of disadvantage and trauma. And that is something that Australia moving forward, I mean, I'd love to be a part of it. I'm not Indigenous, but I'm, you know, I've got many friends that are Indigenous, and I support them wholeheartedly. And I'd like to continue that. I think it's really important for our country. I think it's an important legacy for ourselves, you know, and it's... yeah, it disappointed me. It upset me. I don't like to see that division. I'd like to see us come together and fix some of these issues. And it's going to take, I think, people like me to, you know, that are willing to get their hands dirty and do the work, that have that experience. I mean, we've got a lot of politicians in our country that, you know, went to wealthy schools and wealthy backgrounds, and they've never had to spend a night. Exactly. On the street or in the cold. They've never experienced abuse or trauma or addictions. And, you know, quite frankly, there's a lot of them that are into politics because they make a lot of money doing that. And I want to see some people that are in there that go, well, you know what, I actually am someone that stands for the people and a voice for the people and lead by example.
Well, Shane, there's so many issues you're involved with. Is there one that is particularly close to your heart?
Look, I think it's the youth crime and the youth offenders. It's because they're children. You know, I want to fix homelessness and other things, and you know, there's a lot of factors. People find themselves homeless through no fault of their own. You know, a landlord kicks them out, or they can't afford it, or you know, but adults have a bit more power where, you know, they can go and get a better paying job, or they can educate themselves. They can do things, whereas children are very vulnerable. A lot of the decisions that are being made about them are made not by them. You know, they're made by us. They're made by adults. And so for me, I'm really passionate about the kids and helping the next generation. And making sure that we are providing better outcomes for them.
I think you're just amazing, and I can only wish you the very, very best. And I hope one day I can contact you again and just follow and see what is happening in your life, if that's okay with you.
Oh, of course. Yeah, no, of course. Thank you. Thanks again for having me. And honestly, I appreciate it.
and you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life here in Sweden with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.